Okay, good morning everybody. I was reminded by my students yesterday that it's 3 weeks to the end of the semester, and I thought, wow, you know, where did that time frame disappear to?
Quite scary. I have that perpetual on my calendar.
It's unbelievable. Very good, thank you. So, as far as we're concerned, we're down to learn on the 25th, which I suspect won't happen. I think our last session will actually be the week before the 25th. So we're on today, which is the 4th, and then we're on the 11th and the 18th. Three more sessions.
And the 25th,
I don't think we'll be learning. It's just a public holiday. It's always complicated for people to come in. Before the end of the semester, I'll be talking to the rabbi, and we'll announce the beginning of what I delightfully call the spring semester. Even though it's in January, it's not exactly spring by any stretch of the imagination. But at least we can think ahead and think about happier things. As we've been talking over the last few weeks, and I hope this has become something of a revelation for some of you, the element that I've tried to introduce into a story that we all know. You know, I'll just, again, repeat very briefly my introduction. The story we all know, we've heard this story since literally more or less the moments that the earliest days of our Hebrew school education, this was one of our favorites. And yet, when we look at it, and we have tried to look at it with a more realistic view, the problems are certainly much greater than the solutions. You know, just to try and understand the dynamic of Persian society, and not to see the story just as a little shtetl within Persia, but this was part of the main thoroughfare of the Persian Empire. Shushan was Susa, as it's called, and today there's big archaeological diggings going on there, and they're still going on there. It's a remarkable thing. Somebody in Shul showed me a few weeks ago a video that was taken of the tombs of Esther and Mordechai, with a big mezuzah on the door. But he said that because there's so few Jews now who are prepared to risk their necks to go out there, you know, you've heard what's going on in Iran at the moment, it's terrible. The reality is that it's really not visited, it's more visited by Muslims than it is by Jews. Because they also consider it a holy place and they go and pray there and whatever. It's just one of those strange and wondrous things that, you know, when we find out a little bit about these people, it becomes so revealing. And as my teaching, I always say the same thing, we take nothing for granted. Everything which we assume till now is to be challenged. So our biggest challenge that I think we've done till now is understanding, firstly, the historical background, and that I've spent a lot of time on, and also trying to understand who Mordechai and Esther really were at the beginning of the story. As much as we like to romanticize and find them as being the what I call the quintessential Jewish heroes and the heroine, etc., the reality is that we may be talking about people who are not, at the beginning of the story, so connected in the Jewish community. The big thing we notice, Mordechai is always positioned in the palace. And if he is, as we've always understood, the great rabbinic figure, it'd be very strange in a way to have somebody like that wandering around freely in the palace of the king, especially Achashverosh, who's not, as we'll see this week in chapter 3, is not very partial towards the Jews whatsoever. If Haman was a Rasha, Achashverosh is not far behind. He doesn't want to take money, you know, the whole thing, we'll just read this in a minute. All of what's going on here is clear that not only Haman is the bad guy, but Achashverosh is pretty bad as well. And I think that point in itself of trying to understand at the beginning who Mordechai and Esther really are, their names, their non-Jewish names, which are so, to us, so Jewish, but they're really not. You know, I had a student in London, he's now a rabbi in London, thank God, whose name was Alexander, Alex. And again, Alex was a very Jewish name, but it really wasn't. We adopted it. We took it from the, you know, Alexander the Great. He became one of the interesting people. Not, again, interesting how we try to adopt names like that, even though the history doesn't necessarily allow it. You know, Alexander was on the verge of conquering Jerusalem. And there's a whole story with him and the Kohen Gadol, and it's a whole story for another time, for Hanukkah maybe. Yeah.
Yeah.
When you forget you're a Jew, don't worry, the guy will remind you. Oh, I was going to say that today. And they are definitely, this is part of the story. Haman is there to remind us. And it's one of those scary things. You know, we talk about anti-Semitism at the moment. And at the same time, we know the assimilation rate is through the roof. And there's no coincidence. And I don't know what it is, why the vast majority of Jews don't have any sense of Jewish history. It's always been like that. Whenever we got to the point where things were falling apart from within the community, that we weren't connecting to Jews the way we're supposed to, unfortunately, and I'm sorry to say this, we've always had external reminders of who we are. And that's not new. You know, I mean, you can talk in Germany, but we go back in Spain. My feeling was it must have been like that as well. There was a very committed community. It was also a very assimilated community. People who practiced Judaism in secret, but in public they took on Christianity. You know, there have been periods in Jewish history where, unfortunately, the anti-Semitism has gone hand in hand with the state of the Jewish world as it was and as it is. And today we've got a bracha. The bracha is we've got Medinat Yisrael. You know, I've said this, maybe I said this in this forum, but I certainly keep repeating it, that there should be a bracha we add every single day to the davening. Baruch atah Hashem, shenatata lanu Medinat Yisrael. I say it, I get emotional. The reality is we have a place. We have a place which is a country, may not be the most Jewish country that we want it to be, and we're struggling with that, but it's a country where, God forbid, we should ever be in a tzara, in a trouble, they will welcome you with open arms. Try and come into America and see what they do to you. We went through it. How difficult it is to emigrate to this country, it's very, very tough. Thank God we went through it, but you know what? It's a country that doesn't necessarily welcome you with open arms. They really don't. They make it very tough for you. In Israel, you come as a Jew, and they will bring out the bands. They will literally, you know, they will welcome you at the airport almost, to coin the phrase. It's unreal. And thank God, that should be a brach every day. We don't, and so many people realize this, and so many people don't, right? And I just don't know what to say. I'm really, it's one of those things that I suppose in the course of time, it will become something that will be introduced somewhere into our tefillah, not just Yom HaSmod, but the whole year round. It is such a blessing. We're living in an incredible time. And for all different reasons, which again, I'm not going to go into now. Back to chapter 3. Today's question, which is a very simple question, and we'll get to it in a few minutes, is the holiday, the name of the holiday. The name of the holiday is Purim, right? And if we know a bit of Hebrew grammar, very simple question. Purim, Loshen Yachid, Loshen Rabim, singular or plural, right? The Hebrew word for the lot that they use is Pur, Pei Vav Resh. So Purim, plural, right? Lots, L-O-T-S. So the question is very simple, why is it called Purim, plural, and not Pur, Chagapur? If this was about a lottery which was done by Haman, then why is it not called simply the festival of the lot, of the lottery, Chagapur? What's this Purim? As if they're almost suggesting there's two lotteries going on. Alright, that's already a bit of a surprise. What do you mean two lotteries? What's happening? We'll come back to that. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. The whole question of the use of the lots. What's going on here? There is a historical item here, which we'll learn about in a few minutes. And there's also, and this is coming from Yeshua Barach. He was very into this whole concept of sort of learning from the past to the future. Going back into the Chumash and finding the paradigm in the story of the Chumash, which we can then use to explain what's going on in the story of something like Book of Esther. And he, you'll see, this is the page that I've just handed out. We'll go through this, because again, he says something quite extraordinary. The casting of the lots. Why did Haman do it in that way? He's a big knacker. Why doesn't he announce that on whatever date it is, remember the names of the months are taken from Persia, so these names they would know, Nisan, Iyar, etc. Let him announce that, you know, the Gezerah will be on the 3rd of Iyar, and everybody go and kill the Jews. You know, why did he have to go through this lottery and all this indirect, strange way that he conducts himself to find out what day is going to be the day to carry out the decree? It's strange. You know, it doesn't reflect, in a way, Haman's sense of confidence, which seemingly he has, to announce and to go to the king to demand the death of Mordechai. We spoke about the personal vendetta that they had. And of course, Am Mordechai. How do you get rid of Mordechai, who seems to be very well connected? You attack his people. And if the people are going to be killed, he'll be included in the people. But reality of it is that why does he do it with the lottery? What does the lottery suggest? Why doesn't he, as they say in America, man up and say to the whole world, this is the day we're going to carry out this decree? It's so strange. It's something we take for granted. Of course he used the lottery. What do you mean, of course? Why? Lama. Why did he use the lottery? And we'll come to something which is really remarkable. Absolutely remarkable. I want to read the Psukim very briefly. I don't remember what page, 1254 I think it is. Megillat Esther in the big blue book. In the big blue book. All right, 12, is it? 1254, 55, something. 1254, right? So have a look. It's chapter 3. And we got to the piece last week where... we said that the Haman is elevated, right, and his throne is elevated above everybody else. We're just going to look at it from, just a second. Yeah, Pasuk Vav, verse 6. Vayivez be'enam, it became contemptible, despicable for him, meaning for Haman, lishloach yad b'mordechai levado. He was angry with Mordechai because he didn't bow down. I remember we asked last week the whole question of why not? Isn't he endangering? Isn't Mordechai endangering everybody by not bowing down? So we had to explain about the personal vendetta between the two. And Mordechai would never bow down to him on a personal basis. Because they were both together in the army. The whole story we mentioned last week. But listen to this. It says, Vayivez beinav lishloch liyab Mordechai levado, verse 6. It was despicable for him to attack Mordechai on his own. As you say in Yiddish, as pasnish for him, as the great prime minister of Persia, to bother himself with one Jew. Why would he pay a particular attention? His attention should be to the big matters of state. So what does Haman do? Ki yigidu lo et am Mordechai. He makes inquiries, etc. He knew, the servants for sure knew that Mordechai, they found out that Mordechai was Jewish. This is the point just made. Even if Mordechai did not necessarily come out to be so Jewish at the beginning, but it was known. People did their research. They realized he is a Jew. And vayivakesh Haman lehashmid et kol ha-yudim. Haman took it upon himself to bring a decree to kill all the Jews, asher b'chol malchut Achashverosh, Am Mordechai, the people of Mordechai. And again, we pointed out, Am Mordechai, should have said Am Yisrael. Why Am Mordechai? Because his beef is really with Mordechai. And how do you get rid of Mordechai? For him to go and just go and kill Mordechai, as you say, it's not for him. He's a, you know, he's right up there. He's a high official. So he's got to do a plan in order to get rid of Mordechai. How does he do it? By including all of Mordechai's people. So it could be at the beginning that the whole thing developed from this personal enmity, but of course it became something much bigger. Now look at the next verse. Bachodesh Arishon, Uchodesh Nisan. So it was the month of Nisan, the beginning of the year. Bishnat Shteim Esrei LeMelech Achashverosh, and this is what we said last week. It was the 12th year of the reign of Achashverosh. And remember, Esther's already been in the palace for 5 years, or the process started in the 7th year. So from 7 to 12, there's been 5 years choosing a queen, and she's there, and Mordechai is there, and looking out, and the whole thing with the two conspirators, all of that's gone, all that's been done already. And Mordechai has got great kudos from the king because of revealing the plot. At least Esther got kudos. There's a whole discussion who really got the kudos, but whatever. And Hippil Pur, at that point, on Chodesh Nisan, on the month of Nisan, he makes a lottery. This is Haman. Hu ha-goral lifnei Haman, miyom liyom, from day to day, u'mechodesh lechodesh, from month to month. Strange expression, right? The double expression in both cases. Shneim asar Chodesh Adar. And it comes out to be the 12th month when we know the lottery kicks in and it's going to be the date of destruction. Again, what's going on here? What is Haman's problem? Why does he have to do it in such a roundabout way? What is happening? There's a historical sideline here, and there is also what I can only describe as an amazing insight. On the page that I gave you, if you just turn over, I'm sorry, it's upside down, one side from the other. It's just what Rav Lau, whose commentary I've been following, he just points out something very, very interesting about the date of the lottery, the month of Nisan. And it's something which, again, I didn't know this. Listen to this. It's the piece I'm going to read is just the paragraph halfway down under the heavy print where he brings the verse that we just read. Chokrim Shonim. So it's again halfway down, and it's just a comment about the history of Persia. Something that I learned, which I never knew, and again, it's kind of revealing. Chokrim Shonim, Kvar Amdu Al Kach, there are many scientists, many people, of historians, etc., have looked into it. Shegorolo Shel Haman, the whole lottery of Haman, Haya Mechuvan L'Chagigot Rosh Hashanah B'Imperia Parsit. It was their Rosh Hashanah. Their Rosh Hashanah is the month of Nisan. Interesting, right? Hashana, the year, Shematchila b'Nisan, their year begins in Nisan. And of course, it made me think about the fact that although we say Nisan is the first month, but really Rosh Hashanah for us is Tishrei. Could have been, you know, because they did Nisan, we'd go and do Tishrei. We have this kind of dual Rosh Hashanah setup in our calendar. We talk about Nisan, the first month of the year, but you know, in reality, Rosh Hashanah is the seventh month, right? And maybe because of the Persian Empire, who celebrated their Rosh Hashanah in Nisan, in the month of Nisan, in the spring. Just a thought. But listen to this. He says that Nisan, Nachoga b'takasim, who knew? They used to have ceremonies, Saviv ha-mikdashim, around their temples. Again, they're pagans. Ubermerkazam tekes, what was the main ceremony? Kviat hagoralot. They used to have a lottery every year in Persia on the new year. How do you celebrate the new year? What do? We sit in shul, right? And we eat lots of food and all the rest of it. What do? They sit around and do lottery. Okay, what does it mean? Hamagale et atid. They want to know what's going to be during the year. Is it going to be a good year? Is it going to be a bad year? So they do a lottery. Litrachesh, what's going to happen? Malach Hashana Ba'ah, in the coming year. Interesting. So what does Haman do? Haman kaveh et agoral, larigata yudim. So Haman took advantage of the celebration of their new year, which is revolving around doing lotteries, right? Sort of trying to predict the future. And he fixes the death of the Jews. Umachriz al tarich yud gimel ba'adar. And he announces the 13th of Adar. Kiyom as a day. Sheyuad lekach min ha'elim. It's predicted by the gods. He made it into a religious day from their point of view. Hapur shel Haman. Therefore, this lot of Haman, hofeich lecharitzat goralam shel yudim. This really fixes the fate of the Jews. Asher nidonim lekliya al yedei sar nakman, that have been judged to be destroyed by this vengeful prince. Hamenatzel et hafachuto shel melech koreis betoch hamono, and he's taking advantage. Achashverosh sort of sitting in the palace and is a bit out of this particular loop, and Haman is jumping in and using the occasion of Nisan in the Persian Empire, when they used to throw and have lottery events in that particular month or that particular beginning of the year for them, and he throws in the lottery for killing the Jews. It's interesting. Al Shemosh al Apur Azeh. So Rav Lau says, because of this lot that was done, Yikore Achag Kulo, that gives the name of the holiday. The festival of Purim, Kafish Ne'amah B'Sofa Megillah Ken Kol Yom Eile Purim, is called Purim because of the lottery. So that's a historical suggestion. The lottery was an event which took place in Persia on their new year. The way they used to celebrate, they would throw lots, they would try and predict the events of the coming year. And Haman saw this was an opportunity for him to throw in his particular desire to kill the Jewish people. So, fascinating, right? And again, it's not by chance that this happens when it does. What is interesting, which Rav Lau doesn't talk about, and which on the other side of the page, if you turn back to the first side of the page, you'll see that Rav Bachrach, who, as I mentioned, one of the really unknown Bible teachers of the late 20th century in Israel, wonderful, wonderful teacher, little short guy, short beard, you know, real sort of Yeki type gentleman, and really very, very amazing teacher. He brings to our attention things about this lottery which are truly wondrous. I don't know if you ever thought about it. The lottery was done in such a way that it announces the death of the Jewish people. So you think to yourself, all right, if this is something, as kochsuch, as you say in Yiddish, it's so burning for Haman to get it done, what does the lottery say? We're going to sit around for how long between the lottery and the death of the Jews? It's Nisan, and when's the lottery come out? Adar. What is that, essentially? Sitting around for a whole year. He's basically going to tell people, oh, there's going to be something happening about the end of the year, and you've all got to sit around for a whole year. And it says that he didn't even tell them what it was. It's just that he said, there's been a lottery, something's going to happen at the end of the year. You know what? Sit around and wait. Sit around and wait. And of course, what does it say at the end of chapter 3? If you just go to the end of chapter 3, the famous pasuk, where it says, the last verse of chapter 3 must be on 1255, I would think. It says, Melech Haman, Yashvu Lishto, right at the end of chapter 3, the king and Haman sit down to have a drink, Alechaim, Va'ir Shushan Navochon. And Shushan is very perplexed. Why were they perplexed? Because they didn't know what was going on. The lottery only announced, be ready, in a year's time, something is going to happen. It's like you getting a letter from the IRS saying, in 9 months' time, there's going to be something happening with your taxes. So you'll say to me, but tell me now. I can't wait 9 months. My accountant is going on vacation. You know, I won't be able to deal with it. And Haman is telling the people, no, wait. Wait a year and it's going to happen. And it's strange. In
fact, he apparently didn't want to excite people that they're going to be killed.
Correct. He didn't want to get the Persians excited in one direction. For obvious reasons. What would happen? You'd have Zerizim, you'd have zealots amongst the Persians. They'll say, do it next week. They'll start doing it now. Right? You know, Kristallnacht was before the Holocaust, but the Mamzerim, the Roshoim, they didn't wait. They wanted to bring it about, you know, as early as possible. So they destroyed all the shuls in one night. It's a terrible thing.
Did they have the need of a year to prepare to do
this? And that's the question here. Why did he drag this out for a whole year?
Because
why wait? And it's so...
Maybe the psychological factor of maybe the Persians themselves were thinking something's going to happen to us, and there'd be relief on their part when they found that was going to happen to the Jews.
Going to happen to the Jews. It was keeping it totally paro, totally... You know, and this is all the Purim story. It's all behind the scenes. It's all hidden, right? We don't know what's going on. Even within this little element of the lottery, there's already mystery. There's mystery, there's something which is strange, and the waiting of a whole year. I've never thought to myself that it took a whole year to do this, and why? Why would they sit around for a whole year? Why would they wait? But they were told, wait for the year. They weren't even told why. The lottery, you'll see, the rabbis make a big deal about this. The lottery was cast, but, you know, it doesn't really explain what happened. Look at the page that you've got, and I apologize for the size of the print. It's very small print. It doesn't give details, as far as I remember. I mean, it was going to be pretty gruesome. It wasn't going to be...
Send the army out?
Send the army or people one-on-one. It was good. Literally, you kill your neighbor. All right? I mean, it's a scary prospect of trying to understand how this was going to happen. But once the edict goes out, people are on edge. They're waiting to be told what we've got to do. They don't even know that it's a question of killing anybody at the moment. They just know there's something in the pipeline. But a whole year they've got to sit around. Fascinating. Look at this page that I've given you, section A. Section A on the right-hand side of this page from Rav Bachrach, he comments on the words, Vayivez be'ena. It was despicable for Haman to go and attack Mordechai himself. And he points out that this Vayivez Beinam is an expression we should know, because we saw it last week in the Parsha of Esav. He comes home from the hunt, And what does he see? He sees Yaakov making the soup, the lentil soup, and Vayivez Ve'einav et HaBechorah. Esav says, you know what? I'm going to, he wants my firstborn privilege. I'll sell it to him. I despise it. Because, and the rabbis explain that Esav said, it's a dangerous thing. If I don't get it right, and I don't do the sacrifice the way it's meant to be, I may end up killing myself, right? Being judged for death or whatever. It's a whole discussion over here. And it's interesting, the same word. The word that Esav used to despise the firstborn privilege is the word that Haman is using to despise Mordechai and ultimately to despise the Jewish people. So we see, as Rabbi Bachrach always does, an historical connection through the language, through the word that is being used to describe the hatred of Esav, and later on, through history, it becomes the hatred of Haman. That is point number one, which I think is, again, very interesting. He says, and here is the tremendous Kiddush. I'm going to read, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 lines down. He makes a suggestion here of Bachrach, which I think is phenomenal. He says, you know what? Haman should have, as we said, he should have been a man. He should have gone and declared, this is the day when we got to kill the Jews. But what did Haman do? He hit the whole thing with a lottery. What does that suggest? Says Rav Bachrach, you know what? It maybe suggests that Haman was afraid of Mordechai. Never thought of it like that. Haman was afraid. He thought to himself that if I make this big attack on the people of Mordechai, which is really directed, as we've said, against Mordechai initially, but eventually against all the Jews in the empire, he's afraid. He's afraid that this will work against him for reasons we know now because of their relationship that they had in the army. One of the reasons that Haman felt subservient to Mordechai, and Mordechai made him subservient, we know that. So Haman maybe is afraid. How do you overcome the fear? By making a system of attacking your enemy, doing it in what we say a roundabout way. He's not going to confront him face to face with a sword and say, this is it, I'm going to kill you. But he does it in this, using the lottery, in this kind of roundabout way of attacking his enemy, but doing it in such a way that he can hide his fear of the enemy. He would not stand up to Mordechai because there seems to be an element of fear. It's interesting, when I taught this to a group a few years ago, somebody put up his hand and he said, is it possible that Haman was afraid of Mordechai? I said, wow, what an interesting thought, because I don't know if any of us have ever thought about that before. We know that Haman was an action, he was this horrible, you know, person and everything about him, but the fact that there was fear of Mordechai, listen to this paragraph, and it's a revelation. I'll read it, as I said, 9 lines down. Aval. Begins with the word aval. However, he says, Ulay nitan kavar kan lahargish et hapachat. Maybe we can sense the fear of Haman. Shehaman mefached mimordechai levado. Fits in beautifully. It's what we've been saying. Haman is afraid of personal fear from Mordechai. Ulay mishum shemordechai levado mugan bizchuto. And it could be Mordechai's got all the diplomatic immunity he needs because of the plot which he then reveals to the king. And the king says, wow, even though he doesn't get rewarded, we know that his esteem becomes very high estimation in the eyes of the king. Sheharehu itzil et Achashverosh miyad bigtam v'teresh. He saved the king from that plot. And it got recorded in the book of Chronicles. Lifnei Hamela. Ve'ech ya'iz ata Haman. So Haman comes along now and says, kill Mordechai. So you know what's going to happen? The people are going to turn around and say to him, what are you talking about? Mordechai is the hero. He's the guy on the front page of the paper. King saved from absolute death by Mordechai, Marduk. He's our hero. So Haman, you're going to come along and claim you want to kill the guy? You're out of your mind. You don't go and kill the hero of the day. And therefore he says, how yaizata Haman nishloach boyad? Haman's going to stretch out his hand and try and kill him? Never going to happen. Al-Kain, that's why Haman is so devious. Matzah tachbulah. he finds an excuse. Levakesh me'et amela, a way of asking the king, Lashmid et kol yudim asher malchut achashverosh, u'mordechai yeh bichlalam. If I can't get rid of Mordechai directly because I'm afraid of him, and he's the hero of the day and everything else, you know what I'll do? I'll do what can only be described as the most heinous thing possible. I'll kill the whole lot of them. And if I've got to kill everybody else, Mordechai will be part of that. Wow. And the suggestion that Haman is afraid of Mordechai, that's a radical suggestion. And we're going to follow it through. You'll see it comes up again and again in the story. There is this sense that Haman will go so far and then he pulls back. Right? There is that sense. And it's so interesting. And it's a thought which I've never really contemplated till reading this. And listen to this. I'll just read on a little bit more. It's about 12 lines down. Et ha-pachad hazeh yesh lirok gam pepsukim shelifneiken. We can already sense the fear if we look at the text. Gam sham ra'ah ki ein Mordechai koreh mishtachav elo. He's walking in the street, Haman. And who's not bowing down to him? Mordechai. Mordechai, as we said, even though we explained that this was a dangerous thing for Mordechai to do, whatever, we had a whole discussion about that. But aval huitapak, what did Haman do? He bit his tongue, as they say. He didn't say a word. Velo gila chamato, he didn't start. He just walked past. Didn't get angry. Vekeilu ratzalitalem imenu, almost as if he wants to, you know, walk past him. Haman is upset, ashamed, whatever. He doesn't want to deal with Mordechai at this point, right? Because, and we're asking the psychological reason, and you know what? It may be that he's in fact afraid of Mordechai. Wow. And he says, who eventually spills the beans about Mordechai? Not Haman, but it's the servants, right? Aval avdei ha-melech, asher b'shar ha-melech, those servants sitting in the palace, lo not nulo litalem, they said to Haman, how can you ignore Mordechai's chutzpah that he doesn't bow down to you? V'yagidu lo Haman, and they tell Haman. And he says more, he says that you can see this also later on in the famous story of the meal. Remember, we're going to talk about this, two meals. He's invited to meal number one, and then almost immediately there's meal number two. Esther makes two parties. And again, look at that story. He says, Va'od, yesh lochiach, about 20 lines down, Shehu mefachei memordechai levado. I can prove it to you from later on that he's afraid of Mordechai. Misov perik hei, from the end of chapter 5, what does it say? Listen to this. Kasheh yatsa Haman min ha-mishteh rishon, sameach v'tov lev. Haman is very happy. He comes out of the whole suda with Esther and he's beaming. He's a happy man. Ukiraot Haman et Mordechai. We know the famous pasuk. He sees Mordechai. Beshar ha-melech, lo kam v'lo zam imenu. Mordechai is sitting there, doesn't budge, doesn't do anything. Vayimalei Haman al Mordechai chema. Haman becomes full of anger. But he does nothing. He doesn't take a sword and whoosh, cut off his head, which he's obviously privileged to do, if he was so want to do. Vayitapak Haman, it says he just held back. Vayavoyel beto, and he goes home. And what does he do when he goes home? He calls a family meeting. Zeresh and the Einiklach and everybody else come to Zaydi. And of course, what is that all about? He called his wife and all of his friends. So Rebacha says, why did he hold back? He could have just killed Mordechai on the spot for being, for not obeying the law of the kingdom. Why is he bringing his ganze mishpocha to the house, bringing them all in? And the answer is, mishum shehu adai mefached. Poor guy is afraid of Mordechai. Levado, well, Cain, and therefore bring the family to give him a bit of, as you say in Hebrew, chizuk. Try and sort of bolster him a little bit. Al Cain, who mazmin otam, kedei shehem yichazku otam, lasot boz mamol, they'll give him a bit of chizuk to carry out his plan. This is unreal. All of a sudden, we've got an element here in the story, which, as I say, if you've thought of this before, fabulous, if you've seen this point. But I read this, and as the classical expression, this blew me away. Yeah. About sedition.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, question is, is it going to be translated for Mordechai being seditious, but is it then towards the Jews? What he's trying to say is, yeah, he's got the fear of Mordechai, but what about his people? That's already a ruse to attack Mordechai. Yeah. He's got massive problems.
He must have civil war constantly.
Constantly. 127 countries.
If somebody is willing in his house to reject, because it is
it's in the palace.
That it's Ahasuerus' order.
Yeah.
That Haman be treated in this way.
Yeah.
Then Haman has legitimate cause for fear, not as we can read it, it's not as a selfish thing, but as here's a powerful group of people, they were difficult to beat, Mordechai is their leader.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
They're planning a revolution.
Yeah. And I have to get rid of them. But of course, you have to see underneath it what is really going on. In other words, on the surface, I'd go along with that. I would say it's a good way of looking at it from a surface point of view. Underneath, what we're dealing with are old scores. The old score of Haman reflecting Esau. The old score of being afraid, because this is something which clearly it permeates Haman's personality. Right? He's this kind of very, very brave bully. Right, which of course we know, bullies are not really brave. Bullies are quite the opposite. And this is what Haman becomes. See, your point is great. You know, ishtalev, I can bring it all and make it part of the story, and you're right. But there's something underneath here. There's something rotten in the state of Persia, and Haman reflects that rot. He reflects that decay. So I'm seeing what you're saying, but I'm adding to it. I'm digging beneath the surface. And if you want to try and find a merit for Haman at this point in time, vakasha. But I can't find a lot of merits for this guy. I can't do it.
But I wonder how much of that ability to give him a merit is a reflection of us assuming that that's the nature of the
purpose. Right. This is why this shir is so great. Nothing with me. It's getting you to admit you've got to go through it again and look at it anew. That's fantastic, by the way. Because that's what I wanted to achieve. I wanted someone to say to me, wow, you've made me look at the whole story completely as if I've never learnt this before. Sorry? And everything, that's what I said at the beginning, everything that we've assumed as a given is up for grabs, is up for challenging. And that's what makes it so interesting. It's alive. Rav Soloveitchik always, he had this wonderful line that when he gave a Gemara shir and he was quoting Rashi and Rambam and he quoted Tosfos and he quoted all the people, he would talk about them being in the room. And he would say, they're all sitting in the room, and this one, Rashi's sitting over here, and the Rambam's sitting over here, and they're having this argument in front of us, and it's on the page, but they're really... He made it alive, and that's why he was such a great teacher. People still, he's been dead for 40 years, people still talk about his shiurim in the most phenomenal way, because that's what he did. And that's what we're doing here. And vakasha, I'm happy to see it with that element, but then we've got to go through the whole thing again and look for the traces of what we knew, what we're learning from the old and from the new, and put it in all together. And I'm glad that you're bringing it to my attention, because that's really fabulous. Thank you. But listen to this. Look at section B. Section B, I just want to show you what is going through Haman's mind. We've got two things that we still need to talk about on the page. Section B, which is the fear of Haman towards Mordechai, and expresses itself in the lottery. What is that? How does that connect? The fear of Haman and the use of the lottery. And we'll see how this plays out in section B. Listen to this. He says, Ki Gido am Mordechai, they told, the servants told Haman about the origins of Mordechai. Kan itchil Haman nefached gam me'am Mordechai. All of a sudden, Haman was afraid of Mordechai. Now it goes to the people of Mordechai. Because maybe Mordechai reflects a strength from his background, from his people. The rebellion of Mordechai is not a single person. It fits in very nicely what we were just saying. That there is this suggestion that he sees rebellion in what Mordechai is doing, and that the Jews are rebelling because they're in the exile. They're in the diaspora. And we know, he knows the Bible, and he knows that when it comes to Amalek, there is a permanent state of war between the Jewish people and Amalek. Alkein itchil hapil goralot. So now he's going to make the goralot, and listen to this is so interesting. Hitchil mapil goralot. Lama. The Gemara asks the question, why? Why did he do lotteries? Lama kedei lirot eze chodesh shelo nase lahem Israel bones. Right? He didn't have Google in his day. He couldn't look it up online. So he had to find out what month is free of a miracle. So what did he do? V'kivan shelo haya lechol lebiyamim, ba'lo lechodashim. He couldn't find single days like this. Maybe every day had some sort of miracles, like the Hasidim. Every day is a Rebbe's Yortzeit, right? They don't do Tachnun in the Shtibel. Shenema miyom liyom mechodesh lechodesh. What he explains, what does that mean? Allah nisan. So initially the lottery said, let's kill them in Nisan. Zechut HaPesach. Can't do that because Passover, right? They've got a merit. So let's try Iyar, Zechut Man. That's when the manna started falling. Can't kill them in Iyar. Sivan, Zechut HaTorah. He found out that they received the Torah. It was being given a Jewish history lesson through the lottery. Tammuz, Zechut HaAretz. We know that they entered Eretz Israel during that period, during the summer period. Tammuz. Av, Zechut V'afachti Evlam L'Sason. We know that Av is traditionally a time of sadness, but it's going to be turned around to a time of joy. Can't destroy them in Tammuz, in Av. Elul, Zechut HaChomah. It's when they finished building the wall of Jerusalem in the second temple period, during the month of Elul. Again, not a good time to kill the Jews. Tishrei, Zechut Argalim, Tishrei, there's the Yontus. Marcheshvan, Zechut Sara. I don't know what the Zechut Sara is in Marcheshvan. That's the one I'm not sure about. I have to look this up. But he goes on, Kislev Teve, Zechut Hanukkah. There's the Zechut of Hanukkah, even though Hanukkah has not happened yet for another 200-300 years, but there will be a merit in the months of Kislev and Tevet, Shaita Tida, which is going to happen in the future, and Shavat is Zechut Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the men of the Great Assembly. I'm not sure why it's Shavat, but seemingly that's when they are remembered. And then Adar, Sameach. He gets to Adar and Haman is happy. Omar, he says, Hashta Nafal Pur. The lottery has finally fallen. The month when Moses died. The trouble is nobody told him. It was also the month when Moses was born. Big mistake, right? You thought it was a sad month because Moshe Rabbeinu died. Remember, it's also his birthday. Same time. For who ain't Yodea, but it says he didn't know. Shebazayin ba'adah met Moshe, bazayin ba'adah nolad Moshe. What an error. So Haman, in the end of the day, through the lottery, through the use of mazalot, etc., trying to find out, through these astrological means, etc., whatever he used, the bottom line of it is that Haman was desperately trying to find that moment in the year when he could attack the Jewish people. But we're going to say more than this. Listen to this. Look at the bottom four lines, five lines. Hapur hazeh shehusha azar latzala. In the end of the day, the lottery was a way of saving the Jewish people. Why? Ki zeh harevach. This is the point we just made. This gives a breathing space, shel zman, of time. Shenitan la Mordechai la Esther, for Mordechai and Esther, la sod la sir terat Haman. They got a whole year to undo all the evil of Haman. It wasn't by chance. It's all part of Hashem's way of, in the hidden form of God, in the Megillah, to give the Jews a chance to prepare for what's coming up. Al-Kain Karula Yomim Ha'ele Purim Hashem Apur. And the bottom line, Bepur Hazeh, through this lottery, Nigle HaPachat Shel Haman, we now established that Haman showed his fear. He wouldn't go to Mordechai and stand face to face. He did it in a roundabout way. What's the way that he did it? Through the lottery. And said, Rablau, it was even the way that they celebrated the Yontov, their Rosh Hashanah, was through lotteries. So Haman is very smart. He's not doing anything out of the ordinary. Except the consequences of the lottery are going to be very out of the ordinary. But that he's trying to sneak under the radar, as they say. And it says, Mibnei Mordechai, Mnei Amordechai. He's now cut two birds with one stone. Two birds with one lottery. Mordechai he gets rid of, and the people. Al-Kain, Nilmad, Et Habitui. Now we understand what it says, Vayivez, that he despised, Kabitui Shel Pachad, it could mean not that he despised Mordechai, but he was afraid of Mordechai. Vayivez, the word that we started off at the top of the page, Haman Vayivez was afraid, period. Very, very interesting. Really interesting.
Free for his own safety or just his political position?
Yes and yes, even more. Afraid about everything because Mordechai represents for him a force which he cannot control. He can't overcome. And Haman knows this. And you know what? If you get more historical, and Haman knows he's Agagi from the world of Amalek, he knows the history of the interaction between the Jews and Amalek, and it always worked out very bad for Amalek and very, very good for the Jews. Not that it was always a successful interaction with Shaul, it was a problem. But you know what? Haman understands that this is a person, a force. Both Mordechai individually and the people of Mordechai, it's a force which he is now trying to attack, trying to bring down, but he has fear. And I just find it so different, so challenging. And he says, why did it take a whole year between the lottery and the actual date of carrying it out? That was a chance for Mordechai and Esther to say to the Jewish community, let's get ready. Let's prepare. We know what's coming. At least Mordechai would have known, being in the palace, he would have heard the rumors of what the lottery meant. And he can get the word out to the Jewish people and they start doing tshuva. Says Rav Laum, this is going to be, please go next week's shir, chapter 4, Mordechai and Esther take on a whole new persona. All of a sudden, from being, let's call them the assimilated Jew, they become the people who champion the cause of the Jewish people. In the palace, initially in the palace of the king, the change over from what happened to what is happening, is in chapter 4, not as we always thought, chapter 6, when the king wakes up in the middle of the night, and we always say that's the moment when the whole story turns around. It started to turn around in chapter 4. And that is something really unusual, something to point out. The rest of the page over here, I don't want to go through now, but you can have a look. He brings here the whole discussion about how did he convince the king? The king didn't want the money. The king rejects the bribery, right? The king even wants to pay him. In the end, the rabbis say, the king says, the 10,000 shkalim, come on, you take it and you use it. Right? Don't give it to me, I'm giving it back to you. So Achashverosh is definitely a part of the problem, not part of the solution. And the other thing which he points out at the bottom here is the letter that that Haman sent out. He says he had to convince everybody that the Jews are not good for us. So what did he say? They've always got an excuse. Right? It says, Shehi Pehi, the Gemara says. What's Shehi? Shabbat Ayom. Why can't they come to work? Because it's Shabbos. And what is it next week? Pehi, Pesach Hayom. It's Pesach. And they can't come because it's Rosh Hashanah, and they can't come because it's Yom Kippur. So he's trying to convince the Persian world that these people are not people who contribute positively to the economy. It's shocking, because this has really happened over and over again. I just heard a vort this week from the Parsha of Vayetze, and it sort of fits into the same idea. The ladder goes up to heaven. So it says at the top of the ladder, it uses the words Nitzav, Hashem Nitzav Allah. God is standing at the top of the ladder. What's at the bottom of the ladder? Mutzav, it's standing in the ground. What's the difference between the word Mutzav and the word Nitzav? They seem to be the same root, standing. Mutzav is Ali De'echerim. Rashbam says it's with other people supporting the ladder. If the ladder represents exile, galut. When we go to exile, we come into a society, we mix with the non-Jewish world, and we help them, they help us, the economy begins to grow, we're supported all around. When it gets to the point, when you get to the beginning of the downfall, when things go bad, then nitzav, it's alone. We all of a sudden were thrown out, right? We've been used, we've been squeezed dry. Essentially, look at Jewish history. Every time we've been thrown out of a country, it's after they got everything they could get out of us, and I include England in this, 1290 and everything that happened in those days. It's horrible. And then we're thrown out. And that's the ladder representing this item, which is what we're learning here as well. The idea is that Haman is saying to his people, to the empire, eventually he says to everybody, the Jews are something we've got the benefit when they came into the empire, but they're now taking advantage. Every day is a holiday, every day is a chag. So therefore he squeezes them to the point, let's throw them out, let's throw them away. And that again is part of what's going on over here in the story. I told you about the Purim, and I just want to share this with you. I didn't have a chance to reprint it. But I'll share this. This is coming from a commentary called the Alshich. Alshich, 16th century mainstream Polish rabbi. He writes the following. He says, how did the lottery happen? What was the mechanics? Was it just dipping, you know, like the national lottery? Now we have it automated, right? But once upon a time, you know, you go to a bingo, you dip your hand in the box and you pull out the number and everybody looks on their page and they scream out, bingo. You know, we've all been there. We've all done it. He says no. The Alshich says it wasn't like that. He says Haman was in a situation, as he puts it here, where it describes it. He goes, me chodesh le chodesh, me yom le yom. He says what Haman actually did to make sure, he was so worried that he had to get it right. He had two boxes. Who knew? In one box, he put the months, Nisan, Iyar, Sivan, Tammuz, etc., 12 pieces of paper. In the other box, he put numbers from 1 to 354. Why 354? Because the lunar year is 354 days. So he had one box with numbers 1 to 354, another box with the months, and he put his hand into the box and he pulls out, the first thing, let's say he pulls out Iyar. Now Iyar, the number of days of the year, Iyar goes from 30 to approximately to 60. He puts his hand in the other box, what number comes out? 232. 232 and Iyar doesn't go together. Put them back. And he keeps doing that, pulling out the month and pulling out the number on of the day. Till eventually he gets to Adar. He finds the Adar and he pulls out the date. And you know what happens? As you say in Yiddish, it stimmt, it goes together. The day and the month correspond with the Iyar, not being the month, Sivan, etc., etc. He gets to Adar and then he gets the number around about 320 something. Boom, and it comes together. He says that, I've never seen this before. And he says that's how it worked. That's why it's called Purim. Because it was two boxes. It was two lotteries in one. One box had the months, and one box had the number of the days. Who knew? All of a sudden, the holiday makes sense to call it Purim. Otherwise, I would say, call it Pur, because that's what happened. It was a lottery. Singular. Says Rav Alshich, and one of the real greats of the 1600s, he says, no, it was in fact two boxes, of one box of days, one box of months, and the Nes, Shebetoch HaNes, the hidden miracle, was that the day of Adar corresponded with the month of Adar, and of course that wasn't going to be the day of destruction, but the day of salvation. Go figure. Who knew? And I really, it's, again, as I said, this is all revelation to me. What did we see today? Just want to review very briefly. We've seen, in terms of what we are discussing about the lottery and about what it all boils down to, the suggestion is quite clear that the lottery was something that reflects, at least this is what we're trying to suggest, it reflects Haman's relationship with Mordechai. And that goes back so beautifully to what we were saying from the historical perspective. We also want to suggest that the lottery was something that Haman was using in a way on the back of a Persian celebration that would take place every year. That I am interested in. Maybe I'll go home and Google it. And find out what used to go on in Persia, and we'll find maybe this is, you know, corroborated in all different places. I don't know, but this was Rav Lau said he found this written presumably in whatever encyclopedias or whatever, that in Persia they would have a celebration of the new year by doing lotteries to find out what was going to be in the future. And of course, Haman saw the golden opportunity to do his lottery as part of the lottery celebration. And at the end of the day, why is it called Purim? The double lottery, and that's because there were days and there were months. Miyom liyom, now you understand the verse. Verse 7, it says, Hu agaro lifnei Haman, miyom liyom, there was a box of days, umei chodesh lechodesh, and a box of months. Shnei masau chodesh Adar, eventually he gets to the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, that comes out of one box, and then the yom liyom, he pulls out the number from the other box, 300 and whatever it was, boom, puts them together, and he's got his future date for destruction. Why was there a gap of a whole year? That again is very challenging. And two suggestions. Number one, that maybe the non-Jews would have been Zrizim if they knew what was going on, and they would have started already attacking the Jews earlier than they were allowed to. That's possibility. And possibility number two, which is the concept for Mordechai and Esther to prepare. Prepare in what way? We'll find out, please God, in chapter 4. You'll say to me, prepare by giving them guns. This will be maybe the American solution. Sorry to quote that, but unfortunately people think like that. For Am Yisrael, it's much different. Am Yisrael is about tefillah, it's about tshuva. What we do Rosh Hashanah, tshuva, tefillah, tzedakah, ma'avirin, etra, gezeira, nothing new about that. And of course, what we're going to see from the development here, from the story of chapter 3, is the way that Mordechai and Esther become metamorphosized. They change. Instead of being following the crowd, they become the leaders of the crowd. Mordechai in his way, from his point of view of leadership, and Esther being in the palace, also from her point of view. I'm going to leave you with a question. I'd like to leave you with a little bit to think about. Esther, in the story, till chapter 5, almost without exception, she is not called Esther Hamalka. Remember, we pointed this out with Vashti. She started off Hamalka Vashti, the queen. And then when Vashti loses the position, it says Vashti without the word Malka. With Esther, the opposite happens. It's almost, certainly from the time she's chosen in chapter 2, till chapter 5, we see that Esther is not referred to as Malka. What is the significance of the use of the word Malka in the book of Esther? And believe it or not, this is a wow. We'll get to this, Mitzvah, probably maybe next week already. Next week we're talking about chapter 4, but already thinking ahead. Any final questions? Any final comments? This is, I don't know, I hope this is not too much to take on here. Mordechai, and you know what? We can speculate. My feeling is probably not. He knew there was a problem between the two, but nothing more than that. Why did he go for Haman in such a big way? Because I guess from the army, Haman proved to be very loyal to the king. He needed loyal supporters. Remember, we said politically he's in big trouble. And there is a suggestion that when Vashti was called out, who gave the king advice? Memuchan. Say the rabbis, you know who Memuchan was in chapter 1? Haman. And therefore, because he'd given the king that advice about Vashti, which of course led to Vashti being out of the picture and Achashverosh having a much stronger hold on the community, then who does he go to in chapter 3 to make him the big person? The same guy, Haman. Very interesting connection between those two stories. It's mind blowing. This is so beautiful. I'm so excited that you know you're here and that give you something. This is not Purim yet, but we're certainly way into thinking about Purim, which is always a nice thing to think about. I've got to add, and Bezrat Hashem next week, as I said, read ahead chapter 4 and the beginning of chapter 5. It's a wow. The use of the word Malka. I heard a beautiful share on this from an Israeli academic. It just literally, I've never forgotten it, 25 years ago, and it's a fantastic insight. Bezrat Hashem, to be continued next Wednesday. Thank you, everybody.